pleasure to be here today as part of this panel. The goals for my talk today is really to hone in on the STI elements of sexual reproductive health for men. And I want to briefly review the burden of STIs in men, to describe Bright Futures and U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations, especially as it relates to ACA for STI-related services for males, to review how the USPSTF makes guideline recommendations based on levels of evidence, and to discuss future directions, including national guidelines for men's sexual reproductive health by the Male Training Center that I'm involved with as part of updates to the nation's Title X clinical guidance. So one might ask, as it relates to delivering clinical preventive services, why focus on young males' sexual and reproductive health? Young men have sexual reproductive health needs in their own right, and it's important to address also both sides of the partner equation, as well as the needs of all men. In addition, clinicians have substantial training needs regarding knowledge and interactions with males on sexual reproductive health-related topics. Regarding STIs in the U.S., 19 million new STDs are estimated each year by the CDC. In 2010, 1.3 million cases of chlamydia are estimated, 300,000 cases of gonorrhea, and rates for syphilis are increasing, especially among black men over the last 5 years. Regarding chlamydia rates, particularly in men, in the U.S. by age and race and ethnicity, here you can see that the highest rates for chlamydia occur in the 20 to 24-year-old age range, and then next among male teens. And rates are also highest among black men. Rates for gonorrhea follow a very similar pattern, with the highest rates in the 20 to 24-year-old age range, next in the 15 to 19-year-olds, and followed by the 25 to 29-year-olds. And also still highest among black men. Syphilis rates are also highest among the 20 to 24-year-olds, followed by high rates in the next age range from 25 to 44-year-olds, and is also among men who have sex with men that are not shown on this slide. We also know that few young men report the receipt of sexual reproductive health services. This includes 15% of young men saying that they've been assessed for sexual health, 34% counseled on STDs, HIV, and pregnancy, 5% assessed or counseled on contraception, 7% counseled on condoms. So next I want to review the particulars related to STI clinical preventive services under the Affordability Care Act as it pertains to males. So covered services will be covered for children based on Bright Futures recommendations. And although Bright Futures makes recommendations through the age of 21, it appears coverage will only occur for recommendations through age 17. And the USPSTF makes recommendations for adults, 18 and older, based only on recommendations that are A or B grades. Before moving on to the specific recommendations for males, I just wanted to review, you know, what are the general services that constitute clinical preventive services? And these include screening history components to the visit, physical exam components, as well as screening laboratories, also routine counseling and vaccine recommendations. So let's walk through each of these categories as it pertains to males' STI-related clinical preventive services. So for screening and history and routine counseling, there are three services. The Bright Futures describes puberty, screening for puberty and sexuality, as well as sexual activity, as you can see here. And both organizations recommend providing STI counseling among sexually active adolescents and at-risk adults, and so that represents the B recommendation here. And by default, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has the need, you know, for providers to be asking about sex if they need to know who to provide counseling to. So it's really a B in italics from my perspective, that the adults should be screened for sexual activity. So for these services, you can see that there's relative consistency in the history and counseling for males across both guidelines. Only two services related, I'm really just honing in on STD-related services. fall under the physical exam, and these both only come from the Bright Futures guidance for male teens, including examining for sexual maturity rating and genital exam. We have no guidance or recommendations from the USPSTF on physical exam components for adult men. And then finally, there are a number of labs and vaccines that are described by both organizations. And you can see here that Bright Futures makes recommendations to screen for chlamydia and gonorrhea for male teens, but the U.S. Preventive Task USPSTF states that it's an I recommendation where the evidence is insufficient to support for or against screening for any aged male. Although the CDC convened a consultation regarding male chlamydia screening back in about 2006, these data are not included in the most recent updates to the USPSTF, and I'll talk about that in a second. You can see that there's a number of other recommendations for STDs that where there is more consistency across both organizations in what's recommended or not, including no recommendations to screen for hepatitis B and C and herpes simplex, and recommendations to screen for syphilis and HIV infection among at-risk teens and adults. And both organizations defer to the CDC's ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, for recommendations for reproductive health-related vaccines such as HPV, hepatitis B, and A. So you can, in summary, there are discrepancies between both organizations, particularly as it relates to chlamydia and gonorrhea screening recommendations. So, you know, is there an issue with how the USPSTF use of an evidence-based medicine EBM approach in how it makes STI recommendations for males? So I just want to take a brief step back and think about, you know, what are the steps involved in evidence-based medicine? It involves systematically reviewing, appraising, and using clinical research findings to aid the delivery of optimum clinical care to patients, examining the strength and the weight of scientific evidence on clinical practice and cost effectiveness, as we've heard earlier, when allocating resources. Also, integrating the appraisal with clinical expertise and patient values to apply results in clinical practice. But what happens if there aren't few to no studies? So I want to just use chlamydia as an example in how the US PSTF reviewed the evidence back in 2001 and then in the update in 2007. So in 2001, they asked four questions. Are risk factors useful for selective screening for chlamydia? What screening tests should be performed? Is treatment effective? And the effect on health outcomes on both men as well as women? As you can see, that the level of evidence varied from a 1, which represents usually a randomized control type trial, to 3, based on expert opinion. The quality of evidence in 2001 for risk factors was poor. For screening tests was fair. The summary for treatment effectiveness was good. And I'll talk about the effect on health outcomes in a second. So I just want to highlight some of the issues related to both the risk factor analysis that they conducted based on, you know, the studies that they pulled together, as well as the effect on the health outcomes. Regarding the studies that examined risk factors, of the about maybe 30 studies that were identified, only 10 of them were domestic. The majority of these, compared to women, had very small populations assessed from a sample size perspective. The majority were conducted in STI clinics or detention facilities, and so they don't generalize well to community-based settings. Only 2 of the 10 that were domestic in nature actually examined risk factors among men. This is back looking at the 2001 review based on studies prior to 2001. And then finally, none of these studies were prospective in nature, testing risk factor screening criteria for men. This is in comparison to the studies in women, where actually thousands of women were included in the study samples and thus provided direct evidence, and where some of these actual studies were prospective in nature. Regarding the screening effects on health outcomes, for men there was no data, so it was evaluated as poor. And they also didn't find any studies on the effectiveness of screening or early treatment for men in reducing transmission to women. In 2007, they updated the evidence, but here they only focused on updating research based on any evidence on whether new data was found on the impact of screening on women, of men on the impact on women's health. So the questions 1 and 2 were still based on the prior review back in 2001, so the work in the interim was not evaluated to be included in that review. And then they also, because of new methodology, included questions on harms of screening, harms of treatment, and other types of benefits. And here, too, there was lack of evidence. So to summarize, back in 2001, screening recommendations, they found a small benefit was noted for men to treat asymptomatic infection. Since long-term sequelae is rare and effective treatments for symptomatic infections existed, the grade was an I, insufficient evidence to recommend for or against routine screening. In 2001, the I recommendation persisted because there was no new direct evidence on screening and treating asymptomatic infection in men in reducing incidence of new infections in women. So, you know, one of the limitations that I feel to the EBM approach as it, you know, pertains to informing what's covered is when there's a lack of coherent and consistent scientific evidence because of no data that can impair organizations' abilities to make recommendations based solely on an evidence-based medicine approach. This is particularly an issue in the field of male sexual reproductive health care, where the majority of studies and resources have and continue to focus on services for women. As Dr. Peck reviewed earlier, the IOM report on clinical preventive services for women came to a similar conclusion in that they proposed recommendation 6.3 that a parallel approach, you know, could be equally useful for determining covered preventive services for men, children, and male adolescents. And perhaps as part of our discussion after presentations, we can talk about this further. My question is, you know, why actually is there not a parallel system already in place? One effort that I've been involved with to help bridge some of these gaps regarding the lack of guidance for men's clinical preventive services has been in the context of sexual reproductive health in my work with the Male Training Center. This was established in 2009. It's a program of the Family Planning Council in Region 3 and the Johns Hopkins Medical Institution. We're supported through a cooperative agreement with the Office of Population Affairs, and since 2002, I've been leading updates to the nation's Title X clinical guidelines related to men's health and sexual reproductive health in collaboration with the Office of Family Planning and the CDC, as well as experts in the field. And our guiding principles have been to describe the scope as well as minimum standards of sexual reproductive health care for males using an evidence-informed approach where we rely on evidence-based recommendations whenever possible, but also examine other professional organizations for recommendations across the lifespan, including the CDC and work that they've done, especially related to STIs, and other organizations such as the American Urological Association, where we also engage experts in the field of male health to inform this process, given that no one organization makes recommendations for male sexual reproductive health across the lifespan, and that many services for men's sexual reproductive health lack evidence, and thus recommendations by organizations are missing. And finally, we're conducting systematic reviews for topics that have not been previously reviewed or recommended by organizations. So in summary, we need to do a better job in meeting young men's substantial STI needs in their own right, as well as improve clinicians' delivery of young men's STI clinical preventive services in settings in which they are seen, particularly in the primary care domain. We need data to do this better. We need data to appropriately inform evidence-based guidelines for young men's sexual reproductive health. In the interim, Bright Futures provides guidance on STI-related services to deliver to young men through the age of 17, but we're really missing a substantial opportunity due to the lack of supporting documentation to inform guidance for young men ages 20 to 24, those who are in the highest rates of STIs. And look out later this year for a release of our white paper through the Male Training Center, as well as the Title X clinical guideline recommendations that will be published as part of an MMWR report. And we hope that these will address some of the gaps to inform the field and perhaps future IOM work to support ACA coverage for services for males. I just wanted to end on some future directions, particularly for chlamydia, in that, you know, testing for chlamydia is still a critical aspect of men's services, and the question is, if it's not covered for adult men, you know, what are the types of approaches that we should consider? From a policy standpoint, I mean, we can advocate to the USPSTF to review effectiveness of routine STI screening of males in their own right, as well as explore other methods, for example, to reallocate resources, where we can eliminate excess screening among, you know, older women, where the recommendations may not be as, where screening among those populations may not be as effective, and use the money saved to screen younger men, to think about areas, settings that are doing a really good job in screening younger women, to focus on partner therapy, but understanding settings that aren't doing a good job in screening young women, to think about dual approaches, especially in areas that have high chlamydia rates. And finally, using targeted screening approaches as recommended by the CDC's STD treatment guidelines to test and treat partners of positive patients, including notifying the sex partner to bring their own partner to see the provider, get tested, get treated appropriately, and when that patient may not come in, to think about other methods such as expedited partner therapy, if available by law in your state, or perhaps using other models developed in other countries such as accelerated partner therapy approaches, which are phone hotlines, or expansion into pharmacy assistance, so that partners are get the testing but also the treatment that they need. So with that, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators with the Office of Family Planning and the Male Training Center for their collaboration and support, and thank you for your time.
This worked out really well. Can you all hear me on this? We have plenty of time for questions with our speakers. We have about 20 minutes, and I hope you'll step up to the mic. And really what we've seen, we've kind of seen behind the veil, I think, of recommendations that really result in the policies that we all live with. And so I don't know if you're walking up to the mic. Oh, good, we have a question. So this is a really, I think, important policy relevant discussion for those of us in STD prevention. So please feel free to come to the mic and ask as many questions as you'd like. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Jenny Kane from the Marion County Health Department in Indianapolis. I thought your speakers were animated, and I really enjoyed the presentations very much. I've got two questions, one to Magna. I think just this week I heard about that the state of Mississippi was talking about refusing $350 million from the federal government so they wouldn't have to give any dollars at all to Planned Parenthood, but $350 million that are going to be targeted to women are going to be lost, and there was no talk about how to replace that. Do we know if this is happening in any other states, and how do we
yes.
get around that?
Let me, first of all, would you mind if I stood? Because I'm
going
to do that. Yeah, come over this way. Okay. And by full disclosure, I'm hearing impaired, so sometimes I don't hear everything that's said in a room like this. Let me see if I heard your question clearly, Dr. Kane, and it's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
The question had to do with sort of the political ratifications, given what's happening, one could say, in Texas, around what's happening particularly in Mississippi. And the question is, what I heard you say is, what's the gap between the political reality and the opportunity that's here?
And right, one last question. So these new recommendations for healthcare reform will be in place for the Medicaid funding and Medicare or whatever, starting August 2012, regardless of whether the state takes additional federal dollars or not.
Can you repeat that? I'm just, I don't know how to do that.
So, thank you. I apologize for able to hear clearly enough. I want to make sure I heard the question. So I think I got it. So the question
is, how do we
reconcile the fact that there is, on the public sector side, the payment around Medicaid and specifically the Title 10, what does that have to do, and how will the August implementation of the ACA guidelines, how will that play out? So these have to, the ACA guidelines are going to start with private sector health plans. And it is not necessarily, in my understanding, going to radically change what is already in the requirements for what's covered women's preventive services in Medicaid and Title 10. That's my understanding.
Okay.
The immediate opportunity for implementation has to do with new plans that are coming on the market, not grandfather plans. And there's a whole question about how many women is that really going to cover starting in August 1st, and how many new health plans are really going to be ready to come out the door. So the bottom line is, I think we're going to go through some messiness in the gap between recommendations, policy, and the translation of that policy into the public and private sector. And my sense is that people are waiting to see what happens in the courts before they take a lot of time to invest in putting new plans together to be ready to come out for the get-go. Some states will be there and some states won't. So the promise is probably greater than the reality come August 1st, but my hope is that there's going to be some opportunity to be able to begin to turn the ship.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
That's very helpful, yes.
Okay.
I got one more, sorry. And this is... Okay, thank you. That's good news. Oh, I'm just teasing. For your multi-millionaire billionaire up there, your health economist.
Mr.
Hubbard,
come on up here. Come on up here. He's such a tall guy, we should be able to see him.
Michael, in terms of... the new recommendations with STDs. Is this going to be a tough sell to the plans, or is this going to be an easy sell? You think most of the plans will adopt it immediately?
Well, first let me say nice to see you again, and I bet you didn't believe me when I told you it could be 70 in Minneapolis in mid-March.
You're true. You're right.
Let me preface that by saying that locally in Minnesota, all health plans are by nature non-for-profit. So my perspective and my answer to that question may be not reflective of the whole country. In terms of pain, I would say it's an easy sell. Right? These are not things that are going to cost millions and millions of dollars, even with a health plan of a million people. Well, I guess it'd be millions, but on a per member per basis, this is not big dollars, and they would not put up a fight, even if they were unconcerned about the health of their population, which I don't believe to be the case. I think the bigger challenge is really getting them to focus on these services as a priority in terms of quality measurement of their providers that they contract with, in terms of pay-per-performance, in terms of helping their systems that they contract with to put in healthcare system mechanisms, reminder recalls, outreach, to really get these things done. And I think the other challenge is that if we do see this world happen, which I'm not convinced we will, where because of first dollar coverage, some of these STD services migrate into primary care out of STD clinics, of getting the getting primary care to be interested in EPT services, for example, and to be able to carry those out effectively. That's where I think the bigger challenge is.
Okay. Hi, my name's Carla Imbiss. I'm a physician assistant, and I work for Dr. Kane. I have two questions, but they're sort of reflective of the session I just went to about the underserved. One is that it seems to me like since these recommendations were made on the evidence that's already there, to those who much has been given, much more has been given, and to those who haven't had the evidence because, for instance, TRIC is treated with metronidazole and nobody's going to make a profit on metronidazole. So we don't have the money to study, you know, people who are affected by trichomoniasis, mostly African Americans, mostly older women. This is, you know, not your most enfranchised population, right? So, I mean, since they're already underserved and they're less likely to have evidence, they're less likely to get services, and we're chasing our tails. The other thing around that is that I think it's great that there's a bottom that's being placed, and everybody, every woman will get this minimum coverage for annual screenings that's necessary. But I deal with a population that is very much at risk, and the evidence is showing us that somebody who's already been infected has a 75% chance of getting reinfected within 6 months. So based on the evidence that we do have, we want them back in before 1 year. There's a good chance they're going to be reinfected in that time. And from these recommendations, it doesn't look as though that second or third round of testing, which would be indicated, is going to be covered.
Dr. Marcel, do you want to comment on that?
I think some of these discussions we've had as part of our clinical guidelines revision process, and separating out clinical preventive services, you know, as routine service from diagnostic care and what standard of practice management is important, and making sure that at all levels, you know, administration to clinicians, that they understand, you know, that and then refer to the appropriate guidance. The CDC STD treatment guidance talks about treatment and, you know, the importance of retesting because of risk, not reinfection.
Right, but my patients are not going to be paid out of pocket. Will their insurance plans cover that if they're leaving an STD clinic and being covered with insurance and going to a private provider if our STD clinic doesn't exist or doesn't exist in its current capacity because of the shift in funding?
Magda, do you have any reflections?
Yeah. Well, I think the other piece about it is that we have to do a really clear job at differentiating between clinical guidelines for the provision of care and policy that is about who's going to pay for it. And I'm going to keep on coming back to that, because this is what's gotten blurry. Because the clinical guidelines were used to support the passage of healthcare reform, but that was not their original intent. Those of us who were drafted in to work on the clinical guidelines for women made the choice to step aside and say, beyond that, what is the evidence that would say it should be covered, not that it should be mandated as being provided? And so in the questions that we ask, we just want to make sure that we differentiate between, is it about who pays, or is it about the services that she or he must receive? And that's my only caveat to put out for the previous questioner, is just to say it seemed like it was a clinical question, as if there's a threshold of services. And what the Preventive Services for Women was able to do through the IOM was support the policy recommendation as a threshold of coverage of payment, that she won't have to pay an additional dollar out of pocket. That's only the beginning. And our conversation has to come next after that, because that's been a showstopper. Okay, we don't have that one as a showstopper anymore, even though that's going to be complicated how it gets implemented. Now what, in terms of if it is being paid and she is able to get in the door and she can get preventive health care services, then how do we assure the quality and the content and the appropriateness of that care, regardless of where she lives and regardless of who she is throughout her lifespan, and so that there are no further barriers that she must confront?
And, you know, coverage for prevention has always been held to a higher standard, because it's been also often thought of as elective. I mean, it is for people who are well. So so this is big time, but it is only for things that are primary and secondary prevention, and the services you were describing don't fall into those categories.
So, that's
a good point. Yeah. Sir, go right ahead.
David Martin from LSU Medical School in New Orleans. Again, I'd like to congratulate.
Could you speak up?
David Martin from LSU in New Orleans, and enjoyed the presentations very, very much. It's very helpful to know what direction, or at least get some idea what directions we're headed in the near future. Dr. Marcel, I have a comment for you, and maybe you could comment back. With respect to chlamydia prevention in the U.S., high schools are one of the places that we're looking at, I think, and expanding high school programs is something I would like to propose for improving prevention of chlamydia in the U.S. And in high school kids, young girls, 14, 15 years old, have the highest rates of chlamydial infections, whereas men, young men, follow behind. But there's a crossover that occurs. And so I'd like to congratulate you on focusing on 20 to 24-year-old men. As you pointed out, they have the highest chlamydia rates. And it turns out that young women tend to choose partners that are 2 to 3 years older than they are. And I think that one of the reasons that we're not having as much success as we should have in decreasing chlamydia rates in the United States is that this very high-risk group of young men are not being addressed. Mm-hmm. And so I think it behooves or it will benefit women's health if we can get to those young men and get them treated along with the screening programs that we're carrying out throughout the rest of the United States and family planning, hopefully in other venues in the future, ACA included.
Absolutely. And nice segue into another slide that I had. But because of time, I didn't really want to spend the time in delineating. But the male consultation meeting that I spoke about at the CDC talks about, you know, at who are these at-risk males and what settings are they seeing? And school-based, you know, is one of them, but also, you know, upon entry into both juvenile and adult correctional facilities, STI clinics, as we all could imagine, national job training programs, military. So there are a number of settings that, you know, the USPSTF thinks about it just at a population level, but, you know, one of the things, especially for some of these particular services, to really, you know, understand who's at most risk and, you know, think about ways of looking beyond, you know, the true evidence, you know, I guess what I'm calling more of an evidence-informed approach for recommendations to involve those populations at greatest risk.
Yes, we're working on the Job Corps, and the corrections facilities are doing a lot of testing. But there's a big component of men out there that we're not reaching, and we really need some innovative new approaches to get to those men.
And this is also, you know, based on data from before 2006. So, you know, we've got gaps of data from then till now, you know, looking at college campuses. I mean, there's just not the types of data to inform or the compilation of that data to really think about, you know, has risk changed? Has our at-risk groups changed?
I think we have time for one more question.
That's right. There he goes.
Okay, then. Harlan Rothblatt, Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Is this working?
Sorry.
Yeah. All right. So on this slide, these are all the places where men could be screened previously. But now, after ACA, that's not true anymore, right? So I noticed in the presentation on the IOM recommendations for women that included a lot of counseling options, in the description of what was happening with men in terms of the discrepancy between what they had and women, a lot of that had to do with knowledge and awareness and any kind of attention to sexual health, reproductive health issues. Now we're going to have an opportunity where men will have medical homes, will have other places, will have a medical structure that women had, which they did not have. I didn't see that addressed in these presentations, but it seems to me that's part of the challenge going into one of the opportunities of ACA, is that men now have a medical structure which they didn't have before, in which those kinds of, that kind of awareness, education, counseling, even if we're not talking about screening, could take place, and that the screening-based idea of what was going to happen with men didn't fully encompass all the other opportunities that we had with men now that they have a medical structure. Am I understanding what our possibility is?
I understand your question. My goal for this talk was really to focus in on
I understand totally.
The SCI pieces, and I from a time standpoint, because there's, you know, at least 20 different services that, you know, overlap with counseling on a number of different topics with women, but the data for men is still lacking for the majority of those services, actually for almost all of them. And so, you know, it was innovative for the IOM report to put out a recommendation to screen for intimate partner violence. That is not an A or B USPSTF recommendation. But based on the structure for informing services for men, that would not be included because, you know, we don't have a similar IOM report for men. Right. So I think what you're raising is absolutely what we're addressing as part of our guidance updates for Title 10. That's much more comprehensive than what I presented today, and addresses a lot of the issues, you know, that you're raising. And hopefully, you know, you'll find that those guidelines that can help maybe inform next steps to be helpful in the work that you do.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify, I didn't mean that as a criticism at all. I was just in synthesizing this discussion in my own head. It seemed like, oh, we could go farther in our sense of what was possible for men or available for men.
Could you comment very briefly before we close on the concept of an annual sexual health care visit for males?
So, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was luckily fortunate to be involved with an American Academy of Pediatrics guideline that was just released in December that I led with colleagues as part of the Committee on Adolescence that actually proposes exactly that, an annual sexual reproductive health visit. Now, you know, will that actually, you know, move forward and be taken up by health plans and really, you know, and be thought about as an opportunity, you know, to serve men within the adolescent age range, but also older ages? That's a good question. I mean, I was a little bit disappointed. I don't know how many of you saw that clinical guideline report that came out in December. It didn't get a lot of publicity. So it's available free on the AAP website. We actually articulate male sexual reproductive health care guidelines for male adolescents. I'd encourage you to look at it, and I think that that's the kinds of conversations and discussions that we need to be pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you all so much. Thank you for being here.